bury here. We're living now and we're all in this place. So be sure to smile at each passing face as it draws near. So tarry here.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour. This is your Stosh Steelkowski and
Fanny Crawford,
your co-hosts for the Tall Tales Storytelling Hour. And you just heard Andy Offutt Irwin singing Tarry Here. And Andy is a nationally known storyteller, singer, author, actor, and he has been kind enough to let us use his original song Tarry Here to introduce the show. How are you doing, Fanny?
I'm doing well. I was just going to ask you that question.
I'm doing fine. It's a lovely day.
It is a good day, and we have a great show planned on the theme of unexpected consequences. Is that what we're calling it today?
Yes, unexpected consequences.
That title all by itself evokes all kinds of stories for me. So
yes.
I am looking forward to hearing what you have planned for us.
And it just dawned on me that I think that would be a good title for my biography.
You have had an interesting life. I can see where that would fit.
Okay, so I think we ought to jump right in.
Okay, you're going to tell a story first?
I'm going to tell the first story today.
Okay.
This is a story from a long time ago, and it's one of my favorite stories to tell. I recently told it to a family gathering at my sister's 88th birthday party. And we had a bunch of people from the ages of about 18 months up to 88.
How did those 18-monthers do?
they didn't seem very interested in my story.
Okay. just checking.
And there were a couple of teenagers who had earphones on during the entire 3-hour party. I'm not sure that they knew where they were. but they seemed to be happy. So don't take that the wrong way, teenagers. So in 1947, I was 6 years old. It was Christmas Eve, and I was home by myself. Well, actually, I was home with my brother, Tony, 3 years older than I am. I had a fever, and my mother, always concerned about my health, would not let me go to midnight mass with the rest of the family. She didn't want to leave me alone in the house, so she had my brother Tony stay with me, and he was watching me. He was watching me from the third floor, snug in his bed, while I was sitting in the living room. And I was watching the Christmas tree. My mother had a wonderful collection of Christmas balls that she had saved since her childhood. And every year she decorated the tree just perfectly with those balls. There must have been, I'm guessing, maybe 60 or 70 of those beautiful, some hand-painted, decorated balls on the tree. And I was sitting on the floor with my back against the couch, just staring at the lights on the tree and thinking about what I might get for Christmas. Somebody turned the knob on the front door. The key was in the lock. The door opened, and Uncle Joe came in. Uncle Joe was my mother's younger brother, and he was shocked to see me. I said, "Stosh, what are you doing? Shouldn't you be in church with the family?" And I said, "Yes, Uncle Joe, but I don't feel good. Mom said I had to stay home, and Tony's here watching me." And he looked around, of course, and I said, "Well, he's up in bed, but he's taking care of me." And he said, "Well, I'm sorry to hear you feel well." He had in his hands he had two shopping bags. They were full of wrapped presents. And he set them down near the tree. And then he turned to me and he said, "Here." He reached in the bag and pulled out a long rectangular box that was wrapped and handed it to me. And he said, "Go ahead, open it. Maybe this will make you feel better." Well, I did. I tore off the paper, and inside there was a cardboard kind of box with a picture on it. And the picture was of a rifle. I opened the box, and inside was not a rifle, but what I learned later was called a pop gun. And it was a black metal tube, and it had a wooden handle and a trigger. And Uncle Joe took it from my hand and said, "Let me show you." He bent it over his knee, kind of like, and it clicked. Then he straightened it out again. And he reached into the box and he pulled out a cork and stuck it in the end of the black tube. He looked around and knelt down next to me and said, "I'll show you how it works." And he pointed at the tree and pulled the trigger. Pow! One of the Christmas balls exploded.
No.
Yes. I just sat there staring, and he took the pop gun and bent it again over his knee and cranked it and straightened it out, got another cork, put it in the end, and handed it to me and said, "You try." And so I did. Uncle Joe did it. I think it was okay for me. I pointed it at the tree and pulled the trigger. Pow! Another ball exploded. Well, in the next couple of minutes, Uncle Joe and I took turns and used 10 corks. And there were so many balls on that tree, we couldn't miss. So we exploded at least 10 of my mother's Christmas balls. Uncle Joe stood up and looked at his watch and he said, "Oh, I better get going. I want to get up to church in time for Mass." And he went out the front door. I guess we had kind of made some noise because my brother Tony appeared. And rubbing his eyes, he looked around. He saw the shards and pieces lying under the tree. And he said, "What did you do?" And I started to explain, but he just looked at me and said, "Mom is going to kill you." And he turned around and went back upstairs. Well, I just sat there thinking. Uncle Joe showed me how to do that, and Uncle Joe was everybody's favorite, so I wasn't too worried until about an hour and 15 minutes later, the front door opened, and in walked my father, followed by my oldest brother, Paul, my sister, Marcella, and my mother, and Uncle Joe. And as they came in, my mother stared first at the tree and then at me and said, "Diabolik, what did you do?" Diabolik is an affectionate name in Polish. It means little devil. And that was her favorite term for me at that time. And I stood up and I looked to Uncle Joe. He was standing kind of in the back of the group, and I waited for him to say, I gave him the pop gun and it was Christmas and I showed him how to use it, but he didn't say a word, just had a serious look on his face. And my mother said, "Go to bed, I'll deal with you tomorrow." And I turned and went towards the steps that led up to the second and third floor. And once I looked over my shoulder to Uncle Joe, thinking maybe, but not a word. Well, my mother did deal with me the next day, but since this is around Christmas time, I won't explain what happened. And for a number of years after that, I was really upset with Uncle Joe. I just couldn't understand why he didn't explain things until sometime in my teenage years, I had a real revelation. It finally dawned on me that Uncle Joe, who, by the way, was Father Joe, a Catholic priest, was more afraid of his sister than I was of my mother.
That is a great story, and a good Christmas story, too.
Yeah. Yep.
Thank you, Stosh.
Oh, you're very welcome.
I thought we could, since we don't have a lot of calendar updates for our listeners, I thought we could give what we do know locally, and then talk about some of the other storytelling opportunities that are fairly close by.
Yes.
In the region. Okay. So the most important one, of course, is this evening, and I'll let you do that since you're the director.
Whoa. In in just 9 hours, the lights will go out, and Fanny and I will take to the stage at the Unitarian Universalist Church of Hagerstown at 13245 Searfoss Pike.
Very good.
Yes.
See, you're just a numbers person. I'm going to have to figure out how to code Unitarian Universalist so you can remember it as an equation.
I could say it in numbers. It would be easier. Tonight, we are going to be doing a special kind of storytelling at Stories in the Round. It's the last performance of the year, and this is the end of season 4, and we've chosen a special program, which is The Diaries of Adam and Eve, written by Mark Twain. And it is a wonderful look at the life of a couple through the eyes of the humorist Mark Twain. The title, The Diaries of Adam and Eve, might be a little bit misleading if you decided to look into your Bible and check the words. You would find it will be a bit different. This is about the traditional Adam and Eve. It's about where they found themselves and how they got along. And it is a terrific look at a lifetime of two people. So if you haven't already called Fanny and made arrangements or sent her an email, you should do that
right now. Not right now, because we're on the air, but you can reach me by phone at 301-730-1638 or by email at fanitsky@hotmail.com. Phone number is 301-730-1638. And we still have some seats available, although we are filling up.
That's good.
Yeah. And I'm ecstatic.
We can guarantee you will have an enjoyable evening and and learn some things about
Indeed.
Adam and Eve that you never knew. And maybe even some things that they never knew. So, come out to see us tonight. I promise you, you'll enjoy yourself.
Guaranteed.
Right.
Okay. Well, one of the other calendar bits of information that I thought our listeners might be interested in, there are two storytelling series that are not right near our radio station, but since we have listeners all over the world, I understand, there may be people who are willing to drive a bit or who live close to these sites. So the first one is Better Said Than Done, which is a storytelling venue. Both of these venues that I'm going to talk about are what I would call urban storytelling. rather than traditional storytelling or fairy tales or that kind of thing. So Jessica Piscatelli Robinson, who coordinates that show, is looking for true stories, true personal stories, and all of the sessions that are coming up are focused on that type of story. The first one, the one closest to us in time, would be January 27th at Auld Shebeen, which is an Irish tavern on Chainbridge Road. And by the way, I'll give you her website, bettersaidthandone.com. And you can find more information about all of these dates and all of these themes by going there, bettersaidthandone.com. January 27th, the theme is General Hospital, Stories of Doctors, Nurses, and Patients. And having been to a couple of this series in the past, I can definitely say it's an entertaining evening. There are usually anywhere from 6 to 10 storytellers who tell for approximately 10 minutes or so. And they're all true stories. Most of them have some humor in them, but some of them are also very moving stories. So it's definitely worth checking out as a different kind of genre if you're not used to that kind of storytelling, and just to have fun. February 24th, the theme is Love and Marriage, Stories of Commitment. And March 24th, the theme is Hit the Road, Jack, Stories of Travel, Leaving and Coming Back. And in addition to those themes and those events, there are some other options that Jessica's connected with. There's a special event on March 3rd during the day. All of those dates that I gave you previously are evening performances. But the one on March 3rd is called Roar, True Tales of Women Warriors. And that's 11 a.m. to 12:15. Stories of persistence. And I think those will also be true stories, but they are will be at the Fairfax City Regional Library. And if you want more information, you can go to bettersaidthandone.com. And then there's also a listing on the website for the Lake Ann Coffee House in Reston, Virginia. And apparently there's a series that runs there the third Wednesday of the month at 7 p.m. That's a smaller venue, limited seating, but it is free. Auld Shebeen, you need to buy something at the restaurant to be there. So that's definitely worth checking out. Go to bettersaidthandone.com. And then the other series is run by Noah Baum and Tim Livingood, the Grapevine Spoken Word Series. Grapevine Spoken Word Series, the second Wednesday, 7:30 p.m., at Bus Boys and Poets. But I was a little confused by the website. I have not been to that venue myself. There is an extensive listing of sessions, but I'm confused about the dates. So you might want to go in there and figure that out yourself, or email through the website, busboysandpoets.com. You want to do a station ID for our listeners?
Okay, I'm going to add one more upcoming event and just tell you that there will be a special program in February around Valentine's Day at a venue in Hagerstown, which will be announced at a later date.
Sponsored by Stories in the Round.
Yes. And it's going to be just right for Valentine's Day. And you'll have more information coming out on that in the next couple of weeks. So
I'm excited.
I am too.
We'll have to learn more about that event.
So are you ready to tell a story?
I am, but I think we should tell our listeners that this is the Enlighten Radio Storytelling Hour at enlightenradio.org. And, of course, you can go to podcasts for this program. We'll be up on our website in about 48 hours, and you can listen to past sessions by going to talltales.enlightenradio.org. I'm Fanny Crawford.
And I'm Stasz Ziolkowski.
Your co-hosts for every Monday at 12 noon for the Enlighten Radio Storytelling Hour. So, is it my turn to tell
it
a story?
It is. And are you going to tell us what the story title is?
Yes. Unexpected Returns of an Unexpected Gift. But actually, this story is based on a traditional tale that was documented by the great contemporary Hungarian storyteller Csenga Zalka in her fairly recent book, Tales of Superhuman Powers, 55 Traditional Stories from Around the World. And Csenga Zalka says this story comes from a collection of Sanskrit tales told by the statues surrounding the throne of a legendary king. I just love that.
Wow.
One of the things that attracted me to this story. And you'll see other charming elements as we get into the story. So I want to credit Csenga Zalka for sharing this story and giving us permission to tell it as well. There was once a good and kindly king who believed that the best way for him to serve his people was to live at home in his palace for half his time, attending to the needs of those who came to him for advice and help, and the rest of his time traveling throughout his kingdom, visiting holy shrines, the forests, mountains, rivers, farms, cities, and villages of his people with his own eyes. And the things he saw in his travels were often useful to him as he made governing decisions with his counselors and dispensed justice from the palace. One day, while traveling, he stopped by a lake to rest, and as he sat, quiet and inconspicuous, with a group of other travelers resting by the side of the road, he heard them speaking of a holy man who lived at the top of a remote and formidable mountain, a summit difficult to climb and harder still to descend afterwards. The assembled travelers seemed in agreement that a person's first responsibility in life is to take good care of one's own health and fortune, to avoid paying more in life than one's goals are worth. A person should never exceed one's resources seemed to be the prevailing motto. Now, the king was distressed by this philosophy of life and could not help but speak up. He reminded the others that every new and innovative thing that seems impossible is impossible until someone has the courage to try. Great men do not wait for things to fall into their laps. Fate is powerful, it is true, but so is human effort. This holy man of whom you speak, I would like to hear what he might have to say to me. I understand the journey will be long and arduous, so I will start now. The other travelers were inspired by his words and vowed to join him. They walked together for several hours, but by midday the travelers were tired and wanted to know how much further they had left to travel. "Oh, 8 leagues at least," answered the king. "Well, that is further than we thought. We should go home," said the travelers. "You are giving up?" asked the king. "So soon?" "Nothing is too difficult for the capable. No place is unreachable for the educated. And nothing is too far for those with a purpose." Well, these wise words re-energized the other travelers, and the group continued on their way. Late in the afternoon, as they were passing through a narrow cleft on the mountain trail, a great serpent appeared, blocking the path, spitting poison and flashes of red and yellow flames. The travelers fled in terror, but the king kept walking. As the serpent wound itself round the king's body, sinking those poisonous fangs into his skin, the king walked, staggering with dizziness and pain, dragging the serpent with him. He soon reached the hermit's cave, and when the holy man rose to greet him, the serpent recognized the power of that old man, dropped to the ground, and snaked his way back down the mountain. The poison drained from the king's body, and he knelt before the wise man in gratitude. "What brings you to follow such a dangerous and life-threatening path?" asked the old man. "I wished to see you and experience your wisdom for myself," said the king. "Did you suffer on the road?" asked the holy man. "Nothing worth mentioning," said the king. "A person should improve his knowledge and look for wisdom early in life while one is still young and still healthy in mind and body. It is too late to dig a well when the house is already on fire." The wise hermit laughed at the king's answer and offered him two gifts. The first gift was a magic quilt that provided food, money, clothing, and other resources that a king might need to help his people. The second gift was a piece of chalk. The hermit told him, "Whatever you draw with this chalk during the day will come to life at night." Well, the king was delighted and eager to return to his palace to try out these magical gifts. The quilt worked well enough, and the king was sure that it would prove useful. But the chalk fascinated and charmed him with its properties. He secluded himself in his private quarters and spent the first day drawing men and women, gods and goddesses on the walls of his rooms. And that night, the images came to life, and he spent the night in conversation with them. The second day, he moved to a new portion of the wall, drawing armies, horses, warriors, and heroes. And that night, they came to life with the thunderous sounds of an army in transit. The third day, he concentrated on drawing musicians and dancers, actors and storytellers. And the third night, he spent enjoying their wild and fascinating performances. The days passed, and night after night, in this enchanting and enchanted manner, the king forgot his duties as governor and protector of his people, his duties as husband and father. His wives wept and complained, wondering what in the world had become of their husband. They missed him terribly. The king's counselors and courtiers wrung their hands and complained as well, but they were not sure what to do. The wives of this basically good man, they did know. They gathered together and came to the king in his chambers. He, for his part, was startled to see them after so many days and greatly distressed to see them in tears. "My dears," he said, "what is wrong? Why do you weep? Why are you so pale?" They answered truthfully, "You promised never to abandon us. Why have you stayed from us for so many days and weeks? What can be so important to keep you from your duties to your kingdom and your family?" The king knew, in a vague sort of way, that he had done something wrong. But the spell of the chalk was still strong upon him. He was distracted and found it difficult to listen. His attention wandered. But the women gathered round him in the dawn, waiting till the magical chalk pictures became finally still and unmoving in the daylight. With his full attention on the women, they asked for one favor, a boon or a blessing. The king knew he was in the wrong. He could not refuse them. And he agreed to make things right. The women asked for the piece of chalk in his hand, and having promised, he was forced to give it up. The queens hid the magic chalk. It has never been found or heard of since. The pictures disappeared from the walls, and life in the kingdom resumed its wholesome and pleasant course. You may think that the end of the story, but in fact, the chalk was only magic in the hands of someone with the imagination, creativity, and talent to bring forth the power latent in the chalk. Having experienced the power of his own imagination, the king was ever after able to imagine new and wonderful ways to help his people. And with the assistance of his wives, his governing counselors, and the magic quilt, new prosperity and well-being became his legacy to the land, and many legends and stories were told of his gifts to his people throughout his lifetime and beyond.
Wow. That's really a wonderful story.
Thanks to Chengazalka.
Yes.
For documenting that for us from the Sanskrit traditions.
That was, I just found that to be delightful, especially because I like chalk.
Yes.
Having been a teacher.
I like sidewalk chalk.
Yeah, I do too.
Myself.
I do too. I've given sidewalk chalk to children as presents before.
Yeah.
Nice box of many colors. And
we have some nice paved sidewalks at the Unitarian Universalist Church. Sometime when we're doing storytelling there, we'll have to do some sidewalk chalk.
Yeah.
With kids or with adults.
Or
just you. No, you're going to say that. Okay. I have some sidewalk chalk too.
That story is so charming because it made me think of the graffiti artist.
Mm-hmm.
You know, unfortunately, I'm one of those adults of a certain age who should be,
horrified.
Horrified that building is, someone wrote some kind of weird looking letters and symbols and things, and they think it's art. Yeah, unfortunately for society, I guess, I'm not horrified.
It is art.
Isn't it wonderful yes. that someone could do that? There are some people who would burn down the building or break the windows. Instead, here's a person, either male or female, with spray paint and some buckets and brushes, can make something beautiful on the side of an ugly building.
I've always thought that once you got over that taboo of painting on the sides of other people's property, that it would be very, very difficult to resist making graffiti, becoming a graffiti artist, because there's such freedom attached to all that space, and there's unlimited canvas.
Just amazing.
Have you heard of the graffiti artist called Cornbread?
I've heard the name.
He was from Philadelphia. I think he still lives in Philadelphia. And I grew up in Philadelphia, of course, and my dad had a bookstore there. And Cornbread was an artist of my father's acquaintance, and I actually got to meet him further along in his career. He was probably in his late 20s or early 30s by the time I met him, but he was quite the famous rogue. And guerrilla artist. He was legendary in Philadelphia.
I have a piece of art by a wonderful artist whose job or whose talent has allowed her to do murals of all kinds on buildings in Baltimore and Annapolis in the D.C. area, and she gets paid good money, you know, a worthy amount of money for doing this. And I don't see the difference between her work and some of the graffiti I've seen that has been, you know, chastised and vilified.
Yeah.
Because it's just a different kind of art, you know. I recently was in a museum, and sure enough, I found one of my absolute favorite things to look at. I've seen it in a couple different museums. A large square of canvas painted white. And it's hanging in an art gallery. I mean, an art museum. And it has a beautifully typed plaque underneath of it that says who the artist is and the name of the piece. And
do you remember the name?
I don't. I just stood there and admired and thought to myself, somebody got paid a lot of money for that. And I could paint canvas white. However, I guess you have to have a name in order to get away with doing that. Some people scoff at it. I would rather not throw imaginary rocks at anyone's artwork, even though sometimes I absolutely do not understand why it is important or famous or worth money. But that's my ignorance.
Well, the reason, one of the reasons I love that story about the chalk, the magic chalk, and the king's ability to bring the drawings to life is that it so well captures the black hole that you can fall into if you love doing art or any kind of craft. You can just lose your grasp on reality and just become part of that world. Right. And it's very hard to come back and look at your watch and stop when you're supposed to stop.
Yes.
So you can get to things like radio programs on time and various other commitments.
And that was just a delightful story.
Well, I had a question to ask you about your story about Uncle Joe.
Right.
At Christmas time and shooting, using your new air rifle to shoot your mother's treasured heirloom Christmas tree balls. And your recognition at some point years later that as intimidated as you were by your formidable mother, her brother, Uncle Joe, the Catholic priest, was apparently more intimidated by her than you were.
Absolutely.
So once you had that epiphany, once you had that realization, did that change your overall relationship with Uncle Joe? Did it change how you saw your mother?
No, it didn't change how I saw my mother, although that was 70 years ago. Yikes. But I've gotten over a number of things. But I always liked Uncle Joe, even though I was confused and angry with him about not rescuing me. He was, for a long time, the most beloved member of our family. Mm-hmm. He was always fun. He was very lovable. He liked to play with the kids and the family, and he absolutely loved my mother very much, and was a frequent visitor at our house, and my mother actually went and cooked for his other priests a couple of times when he went on a vacation to the beach or something during the summer, and was away from his priestly duties and having a rest. And that was always fun because my mother would take me with her.
Mm-hmm.
Not so much for company as so she could have her eye on me.
Well, and so that question, which you have answered very well, thank you. And I've heard you tell this story before, so I kind of got some of that, those underlying feelings from your tellings. But having thought of that question, then another question occurred to me, which is that if I put myself in Uncle Joe's shoes in that story, I could make a case for how he was doing you a favor, that he was teaching you a lesson in his behavior and forcing you to take the fall and not bailing you out as he might have done, or at least shared the blame with you. You learned something from that experience, and perhaps it was not all intentional on his part. She was his big sister, after all, so he did have some of that, adolescent or something relationship with her that could have carried over, and even as a priest.
While I'm listening to what you said and I'm trying to diagnose it, maybe, here's what I think I got from my uncle. He was not a perfect man, but he was fun. He did some outrageous things, and I think he was a model for some of my behavior in that sense, because I have often been accused of being near the edge in places where I shouldn't be near the edge. And I do get a great deal of pleasure out of
spontaneity.
Yes, and kind of challenging the norm. And so he was an influence in that way, as well as a good model for lots of things.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to tell another story about unexpected consequences, but instead I think I'd like to tell another story about Uncle Joe that fits into that theme.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Is that all right?
Sure. I had no idea what you were going to tell, and our listeners certainly didn't know. So
I was going to tell about my girlfriend in high school, Jane.
Jane. Uh-huh.
And that's a good story, but I'm going to continue with the theme of Uncle Joe. So my last year in the Army, I spent time with a sergeant who taught me I had a brain. I had been a poor high school student, and I loved learning. I loved listening to things in class. I especially liked math and the science classes, but I didn't care about grades. And my parents didn't either. They just wanted me to be able to get through school and not get in trouble. But I spent 3 years in the Army. In my last year, I met a sergeant who taught me math, showed me I had a really good mind for it, and encouraged me that I should think about college. No one in my family had ever been to college. I started thinking about college. So at the end of my enlistment, there was a family tragedy. My mother passed away, and I had been making plans to try to go to college in Santa Fe, New Mexico, where one of my best friends was a student. But when I came home from Germany and my mother had passed away, I did not want to move thousands of miles away from my father again. I'd been away for 3 years, except for two leaves, and I wanted to be close enough to be able to visit him frequently. And I expressed the desire to go to college, and I had said that to my father through the mail a number of times. Well, he agreed that I would take the money that I had saved in the Army, which was absolutely amazing to me that I'd saved. Somehow I'd saved $1,500. I don't know how. I'd send my paycheck home, my pay voucher home to my mother, and she would return a few dollars a month to me. And she managed to save $1,500 of my pay. My father said we'd use that money, and he would pay the rest of the bills if I went to college and did a good job. And then there was the desire to find a college not too far away. Well, I had a couple of reasons to want to go to college. One is I decided that I would be a better prepared person for the world and be able to get a better job. But also, I wanted to play soccer in college. I'd played in high school. I'd played in the Army. I played for a base team in Europe. And it was one of my great loves in my life. And my uncle Father Joe told me he could take me to show me a college, and he thought he could get me in. It was already August of 1962, just a few weeks after I had gotten out of the Army. I had not applied to college. I had not taken any kind of college test except something when I was in high school that I got a pretty good mark on, and I don't remember what it was. I don't know if it was the SATs at the time. I'm not sure they were invented when I was in high school.
ACTs,
maybe. ACTs, something. But anyway, Uncle Joe came to the house, picked me up, and we drove to Emmitsburg, Maryland, to Mount St. Mary's. It's a small Catholic college, and sort of in the boonies, and Father Joe took me into the registrar's office and said, I would like to enroll this boy in school here. And I was in my Army uniform. Uncle Joe said I should wear my uniform, even though I had been discharged. And actually, I didn't have much in the way of civilian clothes because of the last 3 years. So a man by the name of Guy, his last name eludes me every once in a while, but he talked to us a few minutes, and he said, I'm sorry, we have no room. The dorms are filled, and it's too late to enroll because we don't have any room on the campus. I was downhearted, but my uncle said, I'd like to see the Monsignor. He and I went to seminary together, and I'd just like to say hello if he's available. And somebody at the desk made a phone call. It turned out to be just across the hall, and said that the Monsignor would see us. He was the president of the college. So we went across the hall, and Uncle Joe and the Monsignor had a great reunion. Talked for a couple minutes about seminary days, and finally he got around to asking Joe, which I found astounding. No one ever called my uncle Joe. It was always Father. And he said, so who's this? And Uncle Joe introduced me and said I was his dear sister's son, and she had just passed away, and I was just getting out of the Army, and I had a desire to go to school. And he said, right boldly, I thought, in your registrar said there's no room for us here. And he actually used the word us. the Monsignor looked at me and said, if you could go to school here, would you be a, I thought it was funny being called a boy, but he said, would you be a good boy? I was so proud of myself standing in my uniform. But I said, yes, sir. And he said, okay. He picked up his phone, made a call, and in walked the registrar and said, yes, Monsignor? He said, I want you to find a place for this boy. Let him enroll in school. And the registrar objected. We have no place. There's no place in the dorm. We don't have any room. And my uncle spoke up and said, that's okay. I can find him a place. He can live off the campus. And so the registrar looked at me and said, and what do you intend to study? And I hadn't thought about it. All I knew is they had a soccer team. It was a beautiful campus, chance to go to college. I said, what's the hardest course? And he said, a chemistry major with a math minor. And I said, well, sign me up for that. And the other adults in the room all seemed shocked. And he said, really? I said, yes. I said, might as well start with the hardest. And if I can't cut that, then I don't see any sense in wasting my father's money. I'll go get a job.
What a charmer.
So, and if I had thought about it, I might have thought of something else. But
good save.
he went to the office. I signed up for to be a chemistry major, math minor, and Father Joe and I left, shook hands with the Monsignor, found out the date I was supposed to report to school, and we got in Father Joe's car and drove just a short distance, about a half mile, not even that maybe, out the back gate of the college, down the road to St. Anthony's Parish, which was a small country church. And he said, I went to seminary with Father Tomalski, Father Harry, who is the pastor at this church. We went in, and Father Tomalski was home. There was a housekeeper, but he said, told us that she only worked part-time. Since he was the only priest there, there wasn't much to do. And Uncle Joe explained to him about my desire to go to college and told him the whole story and said, and I thought, you know, Harry, he could live with you until we can get things straightened out at the college. Father Harry didn't say anything. My uncle excused himself and said he was going to use the restroom. And as soon as he was out of the room, Father Harry came close to me, put his hands on my shoulders, looked me right in the eye and said, do you really want to live with a priest? I said, no, Father. I just spent 3 years in the army. I'd kind of like some freedom. And he walked to the phone, made a phone call, which turned out to be directly across the street from the church to a Mr. and Mrs. Roddy's home. Spoke to them for just a couple of minutes, came back and said, you have a room in the house across the street. It'll cost you $1 a day, which was, I thought, was absolutely amazing. And when Uncle Joe came back, Father Harry turned out to be just as good a talker as my Uncle Joe and kind of bowled him over before he could even object. Told him all about the Roddies, who were a wonderful older couple, and he said it would be just like he's living with his grandparents. And it turned out to be just exactly like that. So we left that house. Everything seemed to be in order. I did ask my uncle to make one stop. I looked up the address of the coach of the soccer team, who happened to be maybe 200 yards away from the church on that little small country road. There were only four homes on that stretch of the road. And we stopped, and I knocked on the door. The coach's wife answered and said he was not there, but she would relay any message I wanted. And I just gave him her my name and address and my phone number and said that I would like to hear from him and I'd like to try out for the team. And Uncle Joe and I left and had a great ride home, 2 hours back to Baltimore. And I became a chemistry major with a math minor and fell in love with the sciences and math, and actually spent all 4 years there, played soccer, and had a great four-year career in college.
Had you had any experience with chemistry at all?
Only in high school with one of the great jokers in my life.
So you had fun in chemistry.
I had a wonderful
class.
Time, a wonderful chemistry teacher who, I didn't get a good grade in chemistry, but I did learn a lot of things. And I had a good teacher. Brother Cyril was just wonderful.
So if Mount St. Mary's had seen your transcript before you were accepted, would that have been a problem?
I think so. However, Monsignor Sheridan, in those days, 725 boys in that school, no girls, coat and tie to every class and every meal. He was in charge. And so if he said you could go to school here, you could go to school there. Eventually, I have a great story about my high school transcript catching up with me at the end of my junior year. But that's an entirely different story.
I'll have to hear that story another time.
But it turned out to be just wonderful for me. I made lots of friends there and had a great time. Had a short career in chemistry and then a long career as a chemistry teacher. And played soccer for 15 years. And not, it's not always at college. So that was, and that was due to Uncle Joe. And my Uncle Joe actually paid the dollar a day from my freshman year so that I could stay in the Roddy's house. And of course, they were pleased to have a boy whose uncle was a priest in their house.
That is a wonderful story. And it shows a whole different side of Uncle Joe.
Oh, yes.
Father Joe.
Yeah, Father Joe was, he was not perfect, but he could do an awful lot of good things, and he did, especially for me and for my family in many ways.
Great story. Thank you, Stosh.
You're welcome.
So you'll save that other story,
oh, yes.
The other Christmas time holiday story for
just
another time.
Just to show you, I'm not as crazy about women as people have said. I put Jane on the side to tell a story about a priest.
Who has said you're crazy about women?
Oh, some women. In my younger days.
There's a whole long meandering path that we can go down with that conversation. Oh, very good. Well, you are listening to Ed the Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour, broadcasting from Bolivar, West Virginia, Community Internet Radio. And this is the Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour with your co-hosts, Fanny Crawford and
Stosh Siokowski.
And we are here every Monday at 12 noon. Next Monday is Christmas Day, and that show has already been pre-recorded, but we will have a show on Christmas Day.
Yes.
So
a very good show.
Whatever else you were doing that day,
tune in
at 12 noon.
Perfect time, 12 noon on Christmas Day. The kids will have torn up all the paper and opened all the presents. You have had a great breakfast. You can have a second or third cup of coffee and listen to some Christmas stories.
Depending on what your traditions are for Christmas Day, there are people who may be doing entirely different things.
Really?
On Christmas Day, yeah. Sure, not everyone celebrates Christmas.
Oh, that's true. That's true.
Although we have been telling Catholic priest stories today, so.
Yes.
It is easy to get distracted.
Don't forget tonight.
Okay, I guess I'll do a second.
There you go. That'd be a good idea.
Advertisement. This is a commercial message for the Stories in the Round series at the Unitarian Universalist Church of Hagerstown at 13245 Searfoss Pike. That's Route 58, just west of Hagerstown, a mile west of town. If you know where the Walmart is, we're a mile west of the back entrance to the Walmart shopping center. And we will be there this evening, Stosh Siokowski and I, at 7 p.m. We're asking that everyone be in their seats by 7 p.m. So if you haven't called in to say you're coming, or even if you have, you probably want to get there a little bit early, because we do want to start right on time. It's a little bit longer than our usual storytelling presentations. Not much longer. It's about an hour and 15 minutes, I believe. And we are presenting Mark Twain's The Diaries of Adam and Eve. And we're pretty excited about this. We've been rehearsing for 3 months now, and we are ready to go. So if you like Mark Twain, if you like Adam and Eve, or if you just like a good evening's entertainment and a little deep philosophical conversation and thoughts, come out this evening. $10 in advance, $12 at the door. You can still access advance registration by calling me, Fanny Crawford, at 301-730-1638, or at my email address, fanitsky@hotmail.com, fanitsky@hotmail.com. And if you don't know anything about The Diaries of Adam and Eve, Mark Twain wrote these pieces in late middle age, 1904, 1905, after his wife, his beloved wife, Livy, had died after a long illness. And they had also lost their eldest child when she was young, very young in her life. And so he had experienced some loss and a somewhat long marriage as well. So this story is about what it's like to be part of a couple and the life cycle of a marriage. And it's funny, it's entertaining, but there's also some real thought-provoking ideas and conceptual pieces to this piece, and I think you will enjoy it. So come out at 7 p.m. to the Unitarian Universalist Church on Searfoss Pike in Hagerstown at 7 p.m. And that's what you need to know. My phone number is 301-730-1638 if you have any questions. We're almost out of time, aren't we, Stosh?
We are. So let me say this. You have been listening to Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour, independent community radio in Bolivar, West Virginia, at enlightenedradio.org. The Epic Storytelling Hour offers listeners a window into the world of storytelling by traditional and non-traditional storytellers, encouraging our listening community to share, preserve, and expand all of our stories. Thanks for listening. For the next week, the station will be under maintenance, and so there may be periodic times when you will not be able to access any of the programming.
But you can still do podcasts.
Yes, at talltales.enlightenedradio.org. And be sure to think about tonight and listen in next week for our Christmas program.
Talk to you next.